Rewind. Sound off, 279. How do you think wrestlers should handle fans who get into the ring? Should they physically force them out, attack them, or let the referees or security take care of them? They should kick their ass is what they should do. You don't know what sort of threat they pose. They need to make it very clear, I think, before the show. No fans are permitted to hop the barricade, or they do so at their own risk. I'm not saying that, you know, after you've taken them down, beat them until they're bloody. But you use whatever force is necessary to take them down and isolate the threat. And if that means you get a little stiff with them, well, then so be it. You know, you got to teach these morons a lesson. Either that or take them backstage and lock them in a room with Mark Henry for 5 minutes. I bet that changes his attitude real quick.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Welcome to episode 286 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off, exclusively on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and of course in iTunes. I am the Solid Monster. It is Saturday, August 3rd, 2013. We lead off this week with news regarding TNA Hall of Famer Kurt Angle, who technically is not in the Hall of Fame yet, but is scheduled to be inducted this October. He was arrested early Friday morning on charges of DWI while traveling from the Impact tapings in Wichita Falls, Texas, to Tyler, Texas, where he was scheduled to wrestle at a house show. Police received a call about a reckless driver, pulled him over. According to TMZ, cops detected an odor of alcohol coming from the car, and he was taken into custody. This is Angle's fourth alcohol-related arrest in 6 years. He later went on Twitter and made this announcement. He said, "I am blessed to have the support of my family, my friends, and my company. In light of recent events, I will immediately be entering a rehabilitation center. I realize that this is a pivotal time in my life, and I ask for your understanding as well as your prayers and continued support. I am confident that in taking these steps, I can begin to address necessary changes in my life." End quote. I wonder if he means that he's going to be going into WWE-sponsored rehab, or if it's going to be, if he's footing the bill on his own. Just thinking about that, because technically WWE would have to pay for it if he actually went to them and said, "Listen, I need help," because he is a former WWE performer. I don't think it matters that he works for another organization. So he didn't give any indication of that, but I would be very curious to know. First of all, I'm glad nobody got hurt. That's the best news of all. Second, I hope that Kurt is sincere. I hope he gets the help he needs, because anybody who's met him, as I have on more than one occasion, will tell you that Kurt Angle, no matter what he says publicly in interviews or on Steve Austin's podcast, the guy's got issues. He always has. He's always had problems. You could just see it in his eyes. It's like he's not all there. You know, he's got this distant look in his eyes, like he's constantly sedated. Hopefully alcohol is the only problem he has, and he gets the help that he needs. I think it's time for wrestling to take a back seat. You know, he beat the shit out of his body for wrestling, and now he's got to look after number one. So, my best to Kurt Angle. Hope he gets better. But I have to say, four alcohol-related arrests in 6 years, this man should not be allowed to operate a vehicle. Simple as that. He should have had his license suspended a long time ago. I don't care if he needs to drive for his livelihood. You know, he has to be on the road. It's part of his job. Find another job. I don't care. You've made millions of dollars. Go find another job that doesn't require you to put other people's lives in danger. Very simple. Remember the whole Matt Hardy fiasco from years ago? I said the same thing back then when he was swerving all over the place on the road. I think the final straw with him was he was going to pick up Rebby Sky at the airport one time, and he almost ran a family off the road or something like that. And I said back then, you know, why is this man allowed to get behind the wheel? Now, thankfully, Matt Hardy seems to have cleaned himself up. He seems to be doing well in his life. I'm very happy to see it. I think him and his girlfriend are getting married in October. That's great news. I'm happy for both of them. It shows you that people can clean their lives up. It is possible. So I hope that Kurt can do the same. You know, he's got some little kids of his own. He's still a very valuable asset to TNA. I want to see him do well, but How many times does a person have to be arrested for reckless driving and DUI or DWI before you say enough is enough? Seriously, just stay off the road. Get well and get back once you're healthy enough. And if the problem is wrestling, if that's the root of Kurt Angle's problems, is pro wrestling, then you know what? It's time to stop wrestling. He had a great career, one of the all-time greats. Nothing left to prove. So hopefully he'll get his house in order very soon. We'll get back to TNA a little bit later on. Let's get to WWE stuff here. The other big story of the week, as you have all heard by now, I'm sure, Randy Orton was attacked by a fan after a match with Big E Langston earlier in the week in Cape Town, South Africa. He had very lax security there at the building. Obviously, they weren't paying attention. This fan ran into the ring and had plenty of time, by the way, to kind of get himself ready for the kill. He was standing there for a few seconds. Somebody could have taken him down, and they didn't. He went. Orton was on the middle rope on the inside facing the crowd. He gave Orton a low blow from behind. Orton sold it like a champ. And then I think when he realized it was just some idiot fan, he kind of stopped selling. And the fan was taken away by security. Orton got a good kick in at the guy as he was being taken away, which I think bruised the guy's face up a little bit. Turns out the guy is 20 years old. He is an independent wrestler who calls himself Josie the Wrestling Machine. And here I thought the names they used to give out at NXT were crap. His real name is Shepo Sakabi. So I guess there's one example of a guy who's probably better off being given a gimmick name instead of being able to use his real one. When asked why he did what he did, he said, "I just don't like Randy Orton. This was an opportunity for me, so I got up there and made a name for myself." Yep, sure did. That name is Dumb Shit. Congratulations. You heard some of the audio I played at the beginning of the show. It just so happened I got a question from one of you guys in the mailbag a few weeks ago from episode 279 asking me about fans who jump the railing and get involved. And I just had to go back and play some of that audio because that's how I feel. I feel like when you breach that wall, when you breach that barrier, and you enter what can only be described as enemy territory, then all bets are off. Because, I mean, what if this guy got into the ring and he had a box cutter on him? You know what I mean? Do you know how much shit that security force in that building would be in if this guy went into the ring and knifed Randy Orton? So, when a guy hops the barricade like that, as far as I'm concerned, the wrestlers have the right to do whatever they want to protect themselves. And if that means beat the shit out of the guy, then you know what? So be it. I said that maybe they should lock him in a room with Mark Henry. I was only half joking when I said that. Lock him in a room with Mark Henry for 5 minutes, and like I said, that'll change his attitude pretty quick. I don't have any doubt about that. WWE.com covered the incident, which is very much the opposite of how they normally handle these situations. If it was a work, I have no idea what the purpose would be or why you would want to draw attention to somebody who storms the ring and give them that gratification. You know, when these things normally happen on live TV, they go out of their way not to film it. So they're not encouraging that type of behavior, which is fine. I agree with that. But I guess this is their way of trying to cover more real breaking news type stories on the website. See, the problem with WWE.com is that the website has always had an identity crisis. It doesn't know what it wants to be. You know, 1 second they're covering stories about bogus injuries and storylines and kayfabe and all that, and then the next they're posting legitimate news. They went through this period, I think it was last year, where I guess the idea was we're going to take traffic away from all those news websites like The Observer, SE Scoops, PW Insider, Lords of Pain, all these different websites. We're going to take traffic away from those websites by posting non-WWE wrestling news on our website. So for a while on WWE.com, you actually had listings for upcoming TNA house shows. It was the most bizarre thing in the world. Nobody expected that it was going to work and that it was going to last, and of course it didn't. They don't have it anymore. So they don't know what they want to be. You can't have it both ways. Otherwise, nobody knows what to believe when they go to your website. But they did cover this. They said, footage of the attack was captured by a WWE fan and posted to YouTube and shows the perpetrator striking Orton from behind. The matter is currently under investigation, blah, 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 blah. And that's the other odd thing about this. They actually posted fan cam footage from YouTube of the incident on their own official YouTube channel. It's just very, very bizarre. But I guess they figure, you know, why should all these other websites benefit from the traffic? Why not get some of that ourselves? I was amused by the fact that one of the columnists from Bleacher Report featured one of my tweets in his story, and that story later got picked up on the front page of CNN.com. So my thanks to Jeff for pointing that out. I was wondering where all these new Twitter followers were suddenly coming from. You can follow me on there, by the way, at Solomonster. Cheap plug. WWE did post an update last night about the attacker. They said the accused party pleaded guilty in court yesterday, August 1st, and was charged in order to either pay a fine of 500 rand or alternatively serve 30 days in jail. After acknowledging his wrongfulness, the accused individual was given a 3-year suspended sentence and is not permitted to attend WWE's live events in Johannesburg, South Africa this week. And in my opinion, that's complete bullshit. So his punishment basically is he's not allowed to go to the one show that's left on the South African tour. Boy, that'll teach him never to do anything like that again. That's a great way to deter that kind of behavior. See, in this country, I don't know how things work down there, but in this country, what this guy did was assault. And he should be locked up. So, as far as I'm concerned, he got off easy. Let's talk about Total Divas. I know many of you are just waiting with bated breath for my thoughts on this show. I don't know, by the way, that I'm going to recap this every week. I probably will watch the next episode this weekend. I don't know that I'll be reviewing it, but I figure it's the premiere episode, so I may as well. Show is pretty much what I expected going in. Plenty of embarrassing scenes, but it did have its moments. And you know what? By reality show standards, it certainly wasn't any worse than any of the other crap they air on TV. I have seen far worse. Here are some quick thoughts. I'm just going to go through this real quick here. First, those of you who hate PG so much, and I know there are many of you out there, I'm always getting messages about, you know, PG sucks, when is PG going to go away, we need attitude back, and all that garbage. So for those of you who hate PG so much and have been dying to see WWE move back to more adult programming, you got your wish. Total Divas is rated TV-14. So you guys just let me know when that new boom period hits, okay? The Bella Twins, the Funkadactyls, Eva Marie and Natalya, they are the stars of the show. There is also JoJo Offerman, the other new girl. She barely had a role on this first episode. I imagine she'll be featured more prominently in the future. We also had cameos from John Cena, who was dating Nikki Bella. Bryan Danielson. Yes, that's what they called him on this show. He's dating Brie Bella. John, better known as Jimmy Uso. He's dating Trinity, who is better known as Naomi. Are you confused yet? Are you with me here? Okay, good. I think it's a huge mistake to be using everybody's real name like that. I mean, yeah, in a way, it's kind of refreshing, I guess, to finally hear the name Bryan Danielson uttered on WWE television for the first time. Actually, for the first time since he got voted off NXT. I remember when he got voted off NXT Season 1, he did a backstage promo with Matt Stryker. And in that promo with Matt Stryker, he actually dropped the name Bryan Danielson in the middle of the promo, and it looked like they were going to let him use it, and it was never mentioned again. But anyway, so it is kind of refreshing in that respect, but it's got to be confusing. I mean, if you don't watch WWE television like we do every single week, I just it's got to be confusing to the average viewer. I mean, why wouldn't they just use their worked stage names? I mean, I know it's a reality show, but let's be honest here. There ain't nothing real about reality TV. I swear to God, when they first mentioned Trinity, I had no idea who they were talking about. I just assumed her name was Naomi. I don't know why, being that they don't let people use their real names anymore, but I guess I just assumed that was her name. I had absolutely no idea who Trinity is. Actually, Trinity sounds more like a fake name than her actual fake name. Ariane, at least I knew from her brief time on Tough Enough. She's Cameron from the Funkadactyls. I say brief, by the way, as far as Tough Enough goes, because she was the first person voted off that show by Steve Austin. And it's no wonder why when she claims that her favorite match of all time is Melina against Alicia Fox. That's one of the all-time classic TV moments right there. Sad part about that whole thing with Ariane is that she is the only surviving cast member left from that season of Tough Enough. Just let that thought sink in for a second. Ariane is the only one not dating a wrestler on this show. She's dating some dude named Vincent, who looks like the love child of Dana White and Ariel Helwani. I mean, seriously. Conan O'Brien used to have a segment on his show on NBC, I don't know if he still does it, called If They Mated, which would normally take two celebrities and show you what their child would look like. If Dana White and Ariel Helwani could somehow father a child together, and don't ask me how that would be possible, I haven't figured that part out yet, but if they could, I shit you not, it would look like this guy, Vincent. His big moment on this show was threatening to kick Brodus Clay's ass backstage at a dress rehearsal for WrestleMania because Brodus had the audacity to tell Ariane that she sucked. Brodus Clay is my new hero. That man tells it like it is. If he says that she sucked, guess what? She probably sucked. Who the hell does this guy think he is, anyway? This Vincent character over here. Does he not realize that Brodus Clay used to be a bodyguard for Snoop Dogg? Where do you think he got the name Brodus from in the first place? He'd fucking kill him and then eat his bones. So, of course, Vincent does nothing, largely because the other girls rightly remind him that it probably would not bode well politically for his girlfriend's career if he tried to beat up one of the other wrestlers. She's lucky she even has a job. She's the one who got popped for DUI and then tried to bribe the cop $10,000 to let her go and forget the whole thing. Oh, yeah. That actually happened. I know I ragged a lot on Jack Swagger for his DUI a few months ago and not getting punished, but at least Swagger never tried to pay off the cops. There's one positive about the show. It might be that it gets Natalya TV time and may actually end up getting her over as a bigger babyface than she was before. This is the only potential positive to me that comes out of the show, and it's only a positive if they then turn around and actually push her on Raw and SmackDown. And who the hell knows if that's going to happen, but I'm trying to be optimistic here. If Natalya gets over by the end of this series as a big babyface and then they do jack shit with her when it's over, then this whole thing was pointless. But that I did like. There was a scene here where Natalya was training another diva, and looking on was NXT trainer Bill DeMott and Natty's father, Jim the Anvil Neidhart. On Total Divas, I never would have expected the Anvil would appear on an E! Network reality show, but there he was, and the Anvil certainly does not look like he's missed many meals. He looked gigantic on this show. Natalya's gimmick is something of a shoot in that she is constantly being overlooked for divas less talented than she is, but they have this scene where she meets with the head of talent relations like a week before WrestleMania, and they break the news to her that she has no match, and Natalya just looks crestfallen. I think would be the right word for it. I'm sure she wasn't thrilled about not having a match at WrestleMania, but we all pretty much knew the card weeks in advance. Plus, Natalya wasn't even involved in any major angle or fighting for the championship or anything like that going into the pay-per-view, so I don't really see how she could be so oblivious when they tell her that she's not on the card. So this is one of those many scenes I called bullshit on. You know, I'm sure they ratchet up the drama, they fudge it a little bit. I mean, that's what they do, I get that, but it just kind of takes me out of it. You know what I mean? I mean, I like the idea of being taken behind the scenes as far as what happens in WWE, getting a little bit of an insight, a little peek behind the curtain, so to speak. When half the stuff on the show comes off as complete manufactured BS that you could just see on Raw any given week, it just takes me out of it. I just don't see the appeal. So that screamed bullshit to me. Instead, they tell Natalya that they want her to mentor these two new divas they're bringing in, that being Eva Marie and JoJo. Drama ensues with Nikki Bella freaking out over how much Eva Marie looks just like her. Just her, apparently, even though the Bellas are twins. She only looks like Nikki. So Jane, the head of talent relations, tells Eva Marie that they want her to change her hair color to blonde. She goes to the salon. She changes her mind at the last minute and tells the stylist that she wants to be a redhead instead. So later, she shows off her new hair to Jane, and Jane ends up liking it, and all is well. Bullshit! But, again, made-up stuff for TV, I get that. Natalya really, to be honest with you, is the only likable diva, I think, on the entire show. I mean, I guess Naomi came off okay, but, you know, the Bellas are just absolutely disgustingly hateable. Hot, for sure, but not likable at all. I'm sure it's all an act. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. If Maria Kanellis is to be believed, the Bellas blocked her from coming back to WWE. And it's not that far-fetched to think. I mean, just look at who Nikki Bella is dating. Maybe they are walking around like they own the joint. I don't know. But in any event, it's just weird to me to think that these two are dating the two top baby faces in WWE right now. And they plainly acknowledge this on TV. It's just baffling to me. The story of the episode climaxes. They're backstage at WrestleMania getting ready for their eight-person tag team match. It's supposed to be the Bellas and the Rhodes Scholars against the Funkadactyls and Tons of Funk. Undertaker and CM Punk went a few minutes long in their match, which results in this match getting cut from the show at the last second. I do know that Cody Rhodes was legitimately pissed off about that. And, I mean, who wouldn't be? I mean, I feel bad for Cody, but I'll tell you what. If cutting the Bellas and the Funkadactyls meant six more minutes of Undertaker versus CM Punk, then, sorry, I got no problem with that at all. That was the best match on the entire show. I would have loved to have seen Vincent try to defend his girlfriend's honor by flagging down the Undertaker, cursing him out, or maybe trying to throw a punch at him. I'm not even lying. I would have paid money to see that. Maybe like $10, probably not more. But that would be reality TV right there that I would love to watch. Instead, the girls all cried. And that was that. That was how the show ended. The stuff with Cena and Nikki Bella was, I guess, kind of amusing, if only for seeing John Cena, who's only months removed from getting a divorce, squirming around at dinner when Nikki starts pestering him about getting married. He does buy her a Range Rover, and as Daniel Bryan points out, he thinks it's a bit odd that he gave her a Range Rover before he gave her a ring. Actually, if I'm John Cena and I just got a divorce, I give her whatever the hell she wants, so long as it isn't a ring. I don't find that odd at all. I call that strategy. Premiere did well, did 1.3 million total viewers, making it the most watched series debut since Married to Jonas in August of last year. What they didn't tell you is that it is the only series debut on E! Since Married to Jonas last year. I just made that up. I have no idea if that's true or not, but maybe it is. Who knows? I have no idea how many series have debuted since then, nor do I care. For a comparison, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, which airs right before Total Divas and I guess is the biggest show that that network has, it premiered with 2.8 million viewers, so they didn't really keep hardly any of that audience. I guess that's not such a good thing, but I was very curious to see how that first rating would fare as compared to what Impact normally does, and both shows actually did the same number last week. Technically, Impact did slightly more. But for the 3 weeks before that, Impact did 1.5 million viewers for Destination X, 1.2 million the week before that, and a little over 1 million the week before that. So that's kind of sad, but you know what? WWE and E! Did a hell of a job promoting the show. They had the Bellas making the rounds on the Today Show, doing media, just all over the place. So you would expect that first episode to do well. I mean, the real tale is going to be told over the next couple of weeks when I imagine that number is going to fall. I don't want to say it's going to sink like a stone, but I'm pretty sure it ain't going to be what they got this week. The replay of Total Divas that aired on USA, by the way, after Raw on Monday night, actually did more viewers than the original airing did on E! That did 1.5 million viewers, but just a one-time airing. Show is going to sink or swim based on how it performs on E!, not USA, even though that slot after Raw probably would be the best place for it. All this Total Divas stuff is fine, but I'll tell you what, I don't know why we're being subjected to Total Divas when you've got Legends House sitting on a shelf in captivity somewhere waiting to launch on this WWE network that we keep being told is coming but never actually is coming. And being that I mentioned the network, I was going to save this for later, but I may as well just mention it now. WWE announced their second quarter earnings this week. They had a, you know, an investors conference call, the whole nine yards. I thought it was very, very interesting. In the press release, when they put the announcement out about the earnings, that Vince McMahon's quote mentions the potential launch of a WWE network. The key word there being potential. Why not say upcoming? You know, why? We've been told for how long now that this network is coming, it's coming, and now all of a sudden, the potential WWE network. So I went back to check to see when was the first announcement made about this network. It feels like forever. And they first announced the upcoming launch of a WWE network on Raw in September of 2011. And when they made the announcement was that the network would be launching sometime in 2012. I know the idea was they would launch it right around WrestleMania 28. That would give it a, you know, big launch, a lot of interest in the product around WrestleMania season, and just go from there. So they made the first announcement almost 2 years ago that it was coming last year. And not only has the network not launched, they still can't give a straight answer on when, on what form it's going to take, how much it's going to cost. They have no answers. And as far as we know, they have no clearances with cable companies, or else they would have announced it by now. So Vince McMahon, on this investors call, he made a comment. I read the transcript, I wasn't on the call. He made a comment to the effect of, with each passing quarter, we get closer to the network. And all I could think is, you know what, with each passing day, I get closer to death. We all do. What's your point? What does that even mean? I look at this and I say, this network ain't going to launch. Or if it's going to launch, it's going to take the form of something like what their YouTube channel was or what they're doing now on Yahoo. That Yahoo channel may turn out to be the WWE network. It's not a good sign that they're so evasive and they have no solid answers. Oh, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. It's like the world's worst, most drawn-out porn film. You're not coming. Just stop. Just give it up. Monday Night Raw this past week emanated from... Actually, it didn't emanate from anywhere. It was a tape show from the week before from Laredo, Texas. Want to run through some Raw thoughts here on this road to SummerSlam. A lot of good stuff on the show. They did go and blow off the Mark Henry and Usos vs. Shield match here on this tape show, which I was not happy about. I mean, I guess they could do a rematch at SummerSlam, but Shield won this match fair and square. I don't really see them doing that. It was a good match, one of the weaker Shield six-mans I've ever seen, but it, well, you know, wasn't as long as those matches usually are. Normally they give those matches 20 minutes plus. This didn't come anywhere close to that. Dean Ambrose pinned Jimmy Uso with his headlock DDT. Henry cleared the ring afterwards, looked like an absolute beast in that ring, and the rumor was that it was going to be Henry and Big Show against the Shield at the pay-per-view, but they delayed Big Show's return because he has not gotten clearance yet. His knee still apparently is not 100%. I would have much preferred to see this match get a little more time at SummerSlam than do Henry and Big Show in a handicap match against the Shield. And my logic is that, and Big Show, by the way, just posted a photo on Twitter, I think this morning. He looks to be in great shape physically. Looks like maybe he lost some weight. He's just waiting for clearance. I think WWE is going to have to make a decision one way or the other, you know, by TV this week. We're going to know pretty quickly what the Shield is doing and whether or not the Big Show is going to be back in time. The reason I really have no interest in seeing Big Show in there is, A, I don't think it'll be as good of a match, and B, we already saw the Big Show feud with the Shield. You know, he was in there with them at WrestleMania this year. I don't need to see him program with them a second time. On Twitter, when I posed the question to you guys of who you would like to see the Big Show feud with when he comes back, the large majority of you, and I didn't expect this, kind of a surprise, the large majority of you suggested Curtis Axel as a way to try to get Axel over more. You know, they could play off Big Show's own history with Paul Heyman in the past. I prefer that idea over this one. We had not one, but two Divas matches on the show this week. I can't remember the last time that happened. Caitlin pinned AJ with a spear in a non-title match. Afterwards, Dolph Ziggler came out. This led to a match with him against Big E Langston, another match I figured they would save for SummerSlam, although I guess unlike the Henry match, this one actually we could get at the pay-per-view. That match had a finish. This one did not, which leaves it open for a rematch. AJ attacked Dolph afterwards and caused Big E to be disqualified. So a pretty shitty finish to what was otherwise an okay match. These guys can do better. Hopefully they have their chance at SummerSlam. Christian pinned Alberto Del Rio in a very good match, non-title, obviously. Would not have felt like Monday Night Raw without the Fandango walkout finish and the World Heavyweight Champion being pinned in the middle of the ring. Thankfully, we got both of those things on this show. But the match was good. I thought the finish was real clever. Del Rio put Christian in the cross arm breaker, and Christian rolled through for the pin. Christian won a triple threat match on SmackDown against RVD and Randy Orton to get the title shot at SummerSlam, so it'll be him and Del Rio one more time. Christian must really be getting up there in years. Poor guy comes out every week. He keeps pointing to his ears like he can't hear, puts his hand up over his eyes, and kind of gazes into the audience like he's blind. sucks getting old. By the way, that triple threat on SmackDown, really good match. I would go out of my way to watch that. Cody Rhodes beat Wade Barrett with the Crossroads, but I'm putting this in the good category because of Damian Sandow. He came out on stage after this match was over and talked about Cody Rhodes coming from a family of clowns, which is kind of true when you think about it. I mean, just look at his dad's gimmick with the polka dots and his brother's gimmick. Clowns. All of them. Then he declared that Cody was beneath my constitution, and he walked off. I thought that was a great line. Actually, they aired a vignette before this match with highlights from SmackDown the week before when Cody stole the briefcase and threw it into the Gulf of Mexico. The video package was brilliant. I mean, if there's one thing WWE always does very well, it's those video packages. They do a tremendous job. This one stood out to me for whatever reason. I just thought this was great. I am enjoying this feud. It's just a solid mid-card feud. Cody is starting to get over as a babyface. I think there's a legitimate interest in this match. I don't know if they'll put the briefcase up for grabs in the match. I would think that that would make sense. But we'll find out, I guess, this week. Kane and Daniel Bryan had a good match. A lot of good matches on this show. Nothing great. You didn't have any matches that really stood out as something special, but you had several matches that were good to very good. This was one of them. The announcers tried to get over the fact that if Kane won, he'd be in line for a title shot after SummerSlam. And the thought of another John Cena feud with Kane, I can't even imagine. I just can't. Bryan won clean with the small package. Kane chokeslammed him out of frustration after the match. At this point, out came the Wyatt family with the best entrance in wrestling today. Harper and Rowan ganged up on Kane. Bray Wyatt dropped him with Sister Abigail. And then he cut a promo over Kane's lifeless body, told him to follow the buzzards. And the thing about the Wyatts that I really like, the Wyatts are just creepy enough. They're just the right dose of creepy where I would actually pay to see them star in their own horror movie. They're convincing enough in the role to give you the willies. I think I compared it to the Hills Have Eyes some time ago. I love it. I guess if you're not into horror movies, you probably hate it, but I love it. Curtis Axel and R-Truth had a match. It was just a backdrop for CM Punk to interfere and attack Curtis Axel. He tried to get to Paul Heyman, briefly got to him, but Axel cut him off. Heyman slinked away like a snake. Punk took care of Axel, stared at Paul Heyman as he ran away, and that was pretty much the segment. Simple, yet effective. I didn't care for the match. I liked it for the CM Punk stuff. Just makes you want to see Punk get his hands on Paul Heyman and kick his ass, which is the whole point of Punk vs. Lesnar at SummerSlam. It's less about Punk vs. Brock and more about wanting to see Punk lay Heyman out with the go to sleep. John Cena beat Ryback in a tables match. I was thinking about this. They ought to have a wing in the Hall of Fame dedicated to inanimate objects. You know, you can induct the ladder, you can induct the table, the chair, obviously. The chair should probably be the first thing to go in. Brass knucks, the loaded glove, Hacksaw's 2x4, Jimmy Hart's megaphone. Seriously, I would much rather have that than a celebrity wing. I think I've made this observation on the show before, but John Cena looks like a kid who just got let out of class for recess whenever he comes out on stage. They had a good match, I guess. They worked hard. I'm done with Ryback versus Cena. You know, it's played out. Nobody buys that Ryback is a top guy anymore, if they ever did. I just couldn't really get into it. Cena won with the AA through a table that was leaning up against the corner. Daniel Bryan came out, grabbed the WWE title belt, went to hand it to Cena. He jerked it away. Cena grabbed the title out of his hands. Bryan chanted yes, along with the crowd. I want to also put Ryback's new bully character in the good category. I'm somewhat entertained by it. It doesn't really matter what they do with the guy now anyway. I mean, he's dead. Ryback is done. But it's something for him to do. It's mildly entertaining, so what the hell. The bad on this show. I did not like the opening segment with Vince McMahon and Daniel Bryan. How many people does Vince McMahon need to feud with? Seriously, the last time he had a beef with a wrestler that was mildly interesting was CM Punk 2 years ago. And that was entertaining because they were playing off real-life issues. It was kind of like a work-shoot type of deal, all the stuff that Punk was complaining about. Go back before that feud. What was the last time that Vince McMahon was mildly interesting in a feud, a meaningful feud with one of his wrestlers? And don't say Bobby Lashley for the ECW title because I'll ban you. Okay, that's not a valid option. I've never seen a boss who had this many problems with his employees. All these people who made him money, Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, Shawn Michaels, Triple H, John Cena, CM Punk, now Daniel Bryan. You think he'd be happy at how much money all those guys have made for him, or in the case of Bryan, how much money he could potentially make for him. He not only does not want Daniel Bryan to be the WWE champion because he's too small, he dislikes John Cena as champion also. Boy, this must have been a really depressing decade for Vince McMahon. Vince called Bryan a troll, again. In fact, he made many references to the fact that Daniel Bryan is a small man. You could still book him as the underdog without having to constantly draw attention to the fact that he's not 6'3". Just saying. He tried to stir the pot by telling Bryan the only reason Cena picked him was because he thought he could crush him, he'd be easy competition for him. He says that Bryan does not have ruthless aggression, like John Cena did when he first debuted. McMahon said he hopes that Bryan and Cena spontaneously combust in the middle of the ring at the pay-per-view. Actually, as a promotional draw, that would probably sell quite a few pay-per-views. So yeah, I did not like this segment. It dragged, it was largely pointless, and I've seen much better Vince McMahon promos. Rob Van Dam and Fandango had a match. Whatever happened to the idea of bringing back RVD only for some TVs and pay-per-views? Thought we were going to see him, like, only so often, not every single week. Keep him special. He's already lost some of that specialness that he had when he first came back. He should not be in there wrestling Fandango in the weekly Raw filler match. That's number one. Number two, Fandango once again walked out and lost by countout. Now, I know he had a really good match with CM Punk on SmackDown. Fandango did. I haven't seen it yet. But I can only go by what I've seen. I saw him on Raw. Another walkout finish on Raw. I mean, that may be his little gimmick, that he walks out of his matches to get heel heat, but now it's just beyond ridiculous. I joke about it a lot, but seriously, every fucking week they do this walkout finish. And not in like an I can't wait to pay to see you get your ass kicked kind of way. More like, I would never pay to see you, you suck, get off my TV kind of way. RVD should not be booked in matches like this. Brie Bella pinned Natalya with what else? A roll-up. Diva Stopwatch had this at 4 minutes 13 seconds. It's cool that the girls got two matches on this show, but I don't care for all this ugly duckling nonsense they're doing now with Natalya. That's what the Bellas called her in an earlier segment, and then here, out comes Nikki Bella with what sounded like a kazoo. I think there's another name for it, like a duck caller or something like that. I don't care. It's a fucking kazoo. Natalya got distracted by a fucking kazoo and lost the match. Then, afterwards, she sits in the ring with the saddest look on her face, like she's about to cry. So I guess they're trying to teach kids a lesson about bullying or something. This was just stupid. And lastly here, and this is just a little pet peeve of mine, I admit, I know I'm nitpicking, but my question is, why must Raw always roll on before commercial? You ever notice that? Before every commercial break, Michael Cole, instead of just saying Raw continues or we'll be right back. Kind of like Vince McMahon back in the day. Vince used to go, you know, we'll be right back, stay with us, and whatever. Every single week, it's as Raw rolls on. I noticed the announcers do the same thing on NXT. It's not Michael Cole's fault. So it's got to be a Kevin Dunn thing, I'm guessing. I mean, is Raw a train? Is it a wagon? Enough with this rolling on nonsense, or at least change it up a little bit. You don't have to say it before every commercial break. So yeah, I feel better now that I got that out of my system. The ugly. There was no ugly on the show this week. That's the good thing. It was either just good or just not good. Nothing that was overly offensive. I was not a big fan of this show, even though there was more good than bad. It dragged way more than it has in a while. At least Brock Lesnar scheduled back on the show this week. Also this Monday, Stephanie and Triple H are going to give Daniel Bryan a corporate makeover. I wonder if that means they'll force him to shave the beard. Maybe at the last second, Bryan refuses to shave it, maybe. I do like how Vince McMahon, when he was presented with this idea by Stephanie, just kind of blew her off and said good luck with that. I like to think that it was a little nod to the same angle that Vince did with Steve Austin years ago when Austin first won the WWF title. And Vince had Austin come out on Raw wearing a suit and tie. They took a really cheesy photo together with the belt. And then Austin ripped off all of his clothes and hit McMahon in the balls. So this was his way of saying, yeah, been there, done that, good luck with that. Maybe I'm giving the writers a little too much credit for consistency here, and that's totally not what they had in mind, but that's how I read it. So, anyway, check out the SmackDown main event. I mentioned that earlier. It's a really good match. Orton, RVD, and Christian. RVD always takes the best RKO when he's in there with Randy Orton. AJ also beat Caitlyn with her Black Widow submission after Layla finally turned on Caitlyn. It seems like they've been teasing this for months, and they finally pulled the trigger. AJ and Layla left the ring area skipping together when it was over, so I wonder if that means that she's being added to the group with AJ and Big E. Maybe they're going to be a trio. I kind of like the dynamic of AJ and Big E. I don't think you need to add Layla to that, so maybe it was just one night only. Layla did the turn. She left with AJ, but from now on she'll be on her own and just feud with Caitlyn. I guess we'll find out soon enough. Hey guys, Solomonster here. As many of you know, I am a proud contributor to the Layfield Report, a website brought to you by Michael Cole and the longest reigning WWE champion in SmackDown history, John Bradshaw Layfield. There you'll find all the latest news and opinion from the world of professional wrestling, business, politics, sports, and more. Even better, you'll find me. You can show your support for my work there by scrolling down and finding the latest blog hit rankings on the right-hand side. Then, click on the name Jason Solomon, that's me, for a list of all my latest work. The more people who read these columns, the better, so be sure to share with your friends on Twitter and Facebook and help show your support for the Solomonster and the Sound Off. This week, I tackle the state of the WWE Divas and whether or not we're in the middle of a possible rebirth for women's wrestling. I also look at the current crop of divas down in NXT, why the future looks bright, and my favorite all-time women's feud. Read all about it exclusively on the Layfield Report. Go to layfieldreport.com right now. This week's NXT review, lots of main roster talent on the show this week. We had tons of Funk make an appearance, The Shield, and of course the Wyatt family, who look as though they may have made their final appearance on NXT. Show opened with Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy doing their New Jersey gimmick. Amore plays the role very well. Cassidy looks like he's just trying too hard to be silly. William Regal, still waiting for confirmation that Amore is the love child of Diamond Dallas Page. He could be. Sounds just like him. Brodus and Tenzai came out. They bailed. Did Amore and Cassidy. But Mason Ryan came out to make sure they went back into the ring, which they did. They promptly got squashed. That was that. No actual match here. They physically, literally, got squashed. Instead, we end up with Brodus and Tenzai forcing Mason Ryan to dance with them in the middle of the ring. I was perversely entertained by this. The funny thing is, even after Tenzai and Brodus left the ring, Mason Ryan stood there dancing. He really got into this. He did not want to stop dancing. So for his sake, he better hope they don't saddle him with a dancing gimmick, because I can't remember a person who got saddled with a dancing gimmick who ever got over as anything more than a mid-carder. Backstage, Dusty Rhodes is meeting with Paige and Emma to congratulate them on their awesome match last week. They were interrupted by Summer Rae, the first lady of NXT, as she calls herself. She had some rather unpleasant things to say about Paige and Emma. This leads to a challenge being accepted for next week. It will be Summer Rae against Emma in a dance battle. Paige tells everybody in the room to shut up. She threatens to knock all of Summer Rae's teeth out of her mouth and hand them back to her. Paige is awesome. There's no way around it. She is truly awesome. She's not here to dance. She's not here to kid around. She's here to beat the crap out of the other women in the division. And as I say in my Layfield column this week, when I talk a little bit about Paige and what's so great about her, and how amazing it is that she's at the level she's at now, she only turns 21 this month. Just think about that. She's really, really good, and she's not even 21 years old yet. Charlotte beat Sasha Banks. Charlotte is very athletic, shows a lot of promise, but I almost think she's relying a little too much on her gymnastics background. She's doing all these wacky flips and cartwheels and stuff that just are not necessary. It just comes off as too contrived. She won with her flipping snapmare move, driving Sasha's face down into the mat. Renee Young found Tyler Breeze backstage looking at himself in his iPhone camera. He calls himself gorgeous. As this is going on, there's some dude in the background photobombing Tyler Breeze. I've only been watching NXT for about 7 or 8 weeks, so I have absolutely no idea who this guy was. Maybe somebody could help me out here. The Wyatt family, up next. They did their Raw entrance here on NXT with the lantern, the lights going out. Normally, they don't have the whole big elaborate entrance on NXT, but they did this week. When the lights came back on, you actually saw some fans in the crowd swaying back and forth together to the Wyatt family music. I guess that's something they always used to do during their entrance on NXT. I only first noticed it. But you don't get that on Raw because they darken the arena and the fans, you know, the fans just haven't caught on to the gimmick yet where they sway back and forth. I think that may be something better suited for if the Wyatts ever go babyface. Maybe ditch the darkness and have people rocking back and forth to their music. Anyway, Luke Harper and Eric Rowan beat Aiden English and Mickey Keegan literally 30 seconds flat. Bray Wyatt came into the ring after he laid out Aiden English with Sister Abigail. Crowd chanted one more time, and Bray Wyatt could only smile. Like a very good heel, he did not listen to them. He cut a really good promo that was basically his own little goodbye, it sounded like, to NXT. I take it that this will be their final segment there until WWE decides to bring them back anyway, like they do with The Shield. He said they're off to bring down the machine. I don't know if he meant WWE or if he was talking specifically about Kane, who is in fact the Big Red Machine. Crowd chanted, "Thank you, Bray." Actually, the entire Wyatt family from the moment they walked out were massively over with the crowd at Full Sail University. They came off like legit stars in this segment. So it's only a matter of time. I think slowly but surely they'll have more exposure on Raw. They've only made a few appearances so far. I think they're going to get over big time. This is an act that has money written all over it. You can feud Bray Wyatt with any number of people, not just Kane. You could feud him with The Undertaker down the road at some point. I don't know that I necessarily see that as a WrestleMania match, and if Undertaker's only going to do WrestleMania, then I guess we won't see it. But I could see him against either one of the Brothers of Destruction. I could see him against, you know, Rey Mysterio if he ever comes back. I could see him and CM Punk down the road, him and John Cena, although I think we're a ways off from that. Stick him in there with pretty much anybody. You get a whole bunch of fresh matches out of it. I think the future looks bright for the Wyatt family. Corey Graves, one half of the NXT Tag Team Champions with Adrian Neville, beat Scott Dawson in about 2 minutes with his submission hold. I believe he calls it Lucky 13. So the match is over. He and Neville are in the ring together celebrating when all of a sudden we hear
Sierra Hotel, India, Echo, Lima, Delta, Shield.
Rollins, Reigns, and Ambrose come out on stage to a massive reaction from the crowd. Yeah, they're probably looking at these guys going, look, real stars, those guys from TV. Seth Rollins talks first. Dean Ambrose gets the stick after that. He calls Adrian Neville a thief, who only has a belt. Yes, he said belt. He only has a belt because he stole Cassius Ohno's spot, which gets one of those oh-snap reactions from the crowd. Speaking of Ohno, he has seemingly been replaced, I noticed, in the intro to the show by Tyler Breeze. No sign at all anymore of Cassius Ohno in the intro to NXT. That cannot be a good sign, unless it means he's being brought up to the main roster, and if those reports of him being chastised for his physique are true, then he ain't coming up to the main roster. So I don't know what to make of that. But Neville challenges Ambrose to a match for his United States Championship. Ambrose accepts the match for next week. So it appears that Dean Ambrose cannot defend the U.S. title at SummerSlam, but he can defend it on NXT. Reigns said nothing, by the way. Not a word. He just stood there and laughed every time Seth Rollins or Dean Ambrose would make a point. You know, on the one hand, that's probably the best role for him. He's the heavy. He doesn't need to speak. Just stand there, look big and mean. On the other hand, this is developmental. I love the hell out of NXT, and sometimes I have to take a step back and just remind myself that when there's a bad match or a blown spot, it's because it's developmental. The whole point is for them to get more seasoning, to work. Some of them have lots of wrestling experience. A guy like, you know, like a Cassius Ohno, for example, even a Corey Graves, who used to be Sterling, James Keenan. There's a lot of people on the NXT roster, Adrian Neville, who were very accomplished indie wrestlers before they came there. And there's also a lot of guys that don't have a whole lot of wrestling experience, or they're just not that good. The whole point is for them to get better, for them to find themselves, find their character, find their voice. They're going to be a little rough around the edges. So, you know, I bring this up because if Roman Reigns, let's say, if his weakness is his promo skills, and from what I've heard of him so far, he's not terrible, but we've yet to hear Roman Reigns actually cut his own promo, like a lengthy promo, more than 10 seconds. So if he doesn't work on his promo skills here, where is he supposed to do it? So it's kind of a double-edged sword there. But anyway, the main event, Bo Dallas and Sami Zayn against Antonio Cesaro and Leo Kruger. Lots of international flavor here in this match. Cesaro got a babyface reaction coming out. Crowd loves to chant, "We the People," when he's out there. Lots of good action here. You need to find this match because it wasn't the best match I've seen on NXT, not even close, but it was still very good. And each guy has his own distinct style, especially, you know, Zayn and Cesaro. You know what you're going to get. Kruger, more of a methodical wrestler. I don't want to say boring, but more of a methodical wrestler, brawler type. Bo Dallas is just your white meat, bread and butter babyface that the people absolutely detest. They cannot stand this man. Even, you know, again, he's done nothing wrong so far. It's not even like they're teasing a heel turn with him, like he's doing devious things and being overly obnoxious. He's just being Bo Dallas. They're not really teasing anything with him. I assume at some point he's going to go heel, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. The people just don't like him. I guess they just feel like either he's too corny and cheesy. Maybe they feel like he's being shoved down their throats. He doesn't deserve to be champion. I don't know what it is. But if they do turn him, I think he could be huge. I just think the one thing about him is he needs a new finisher. We saw it here in this match. Leo Kruger is the number one contender to Bo Dallas' NXT title. What they did here in this match, they had him kick out of Bo Dallas' belly-to-belly suplex. That's his finisher. A belly-to-belly suplex that when he does it, it doesn't even look good. I think I've seen Big E Langston do a belly-to-belly suplex, and when Big E Langston does a belly-to-belly suplex, it actually looks kind of devastating. Not when Bo Dallas does it. So the one thing he needs is a new finisher. Kruger kicked out. Kruger nails Dallas with the slice, which is his own little lariat-like clothesline, and he got the pin. So they're planting the seed that, hey, you know, Leo Kruger just pinned the champion. He's got a good shot of taking the title from him, even though Wrestling 101 would dictate that by the very nature of him winning this match, that probably means Kruger is not going to win the title in their match. I'm not really a huge fan of Leo Kruger. I got to be honest with you. He's just another guy on the roster. His look, his shtick, I mean, it just doesn't do anything for me. He's just another guy that they can stick in there, I guess, to challenge Bo Dallas for the title. If I had say in the matter, I'd keep the title on Bo Dallas. I certainly wouldn't put it on Leo Kruger. I think the reactions that Bo Dallas is getting, even if they're bad reactions, at least it's a reaction. It's kind of like the John Cena thing. For the time being, the thing is, Bo Dallas hasn't been around for 8 years, so I'm not exactly that sick of him yet. So I don't know if that match is next week. They may have announced it for next week. Maybe I missed it, but Kruger will get the next title shot. So that was NXT. Again, 45 minutes or so of solid wrestling, some entertaining stuff. If you're not watching NXT, I actually posted a link. Somebody on YouTube posted the full episode this week. I don't know if it's still up or if it's been taken down. You can go on my Facebook page, facebook.com/TheSolemonster. Send me a friend request. If it's still up, you can watch it. Sample it. See if you like it. I think you will. I think you'll enjoy NXT, and then you can buy it on Hulu Plus. I think it's like whatever it is, $7.99 a month or something like that, and you can get all the NXT you want. And if you live internationally, then you don't have to pay anything because you probably get NXT on TV. Let's switch over to TNA. Oh, TNA. I covered the Kurt Angle stuff already, but before the Kurt Angle situation unfolded yesterday, the big story had to do with the big August 1st reveal. So we're going to start with the end of Impact this week, and then we'll work our way around to everything else. Main Event Mafia came out to make Aces and Sevens. That's my name for them now, because they no longer have eight members. So they came out to make Aces and Sevens an offer they couldn't refuse. Actually, Aces and Sixes is probably more accurate. Taz was there, but Hulk Hogan had barred him from entering the building. And Bully Ray did not come out with the rest of Aces and Eights for the main event. So Aces and Sixes. They were led by their VP, Mr. Anderson. Can't we impeach a VP from office? Are we allowed to do that? Because if we can, we should. Kurt Angle challenged them to a 5-on-5 match in 2 weeks. There's going to be another special edition of Impact, the Hardcore Justice edition of Impact, which will air live on Spike TV August 15th. And according to Kurt, the loser of the fall, the man who gets pinned or taps out, will be forced to leave TNA forever. So another retirement stipulation that nobody believes in. They all started fighting. Rampage Jackson was in there throwing some of the lamest shots ever thrown by a pro wrestler or an MMA fighter. And the last thing I want to do is piss off Rampage Jackson. Believe me, if I bumped into him in a dark alley, I'd shit my pants. I've seen him fight before. He's an intimidating guy. He's a lot bigger than I am. But for whatever reason, in this environment, he's in there. He looks just completely lost. He's throwing some of the softest shots you'll ever see. So, aces and sevens retreated outside the ring. Anderson accepted the challenge, so it's official. Now, we know the five members of the Main Event Mafia, although I guess with Kurt Angle now headed to rehab, this may turn into a four-on-four match, but either way, I guess this means that Rampage is going to have his first official TNA match in 2 weeks on Impact. Aces and sevens, Taz can't wrestle, Bully's already got a cage match with Chris Sabin, so I guess it'll be Anderson, Devon, Nux, which, by the way, is one of the dumbest names I've ever heard, but whatever. They can't call him Knox, so they call him Nux. Garrett Bischoff and Wes Briscoe. So they should be the five, unless they make it a four-on-four. They should be the five representing their team. So who takes the fall, I guess, is the big question. A lot of people now may say, well, it'll be Kurt Angle. That assumes that Kurt Angle is wrestling, and as far as I know, Kurt Angle's going to rehab. He should be going into rehab right away. If Kurt Angle is going to stick around for another 2 weeks so that he can wrestle and then go to rehab, I think that's dumb. If you've got a problem, you go to rehab. So it ain't going to be Kurt Angle. I wish it were Anderson, but I admit I don't see that happening. So I have a theory about this, as many of you probably do. I'll get to that theory in a second. Let's talk about what came up next. Lights went out, and out comes the mystery man on the ramp. Wasn't Hardcore Holly. Wasn't Adam Pearce. Wasn't one of TNA's debt collectors. Nope. It was Tito Ortiz. Yes, yet another MMA fighter. The third, if you include King Mo and Rampage Jackson, that TNA has brought in within the past year. And in that year, total number of matches they've wrestled, all of these men, zero. Goose egg. Not one match. Not one major angle. They had one really good segment on Impact with Rampage and Kurt Angle that went nowhere when Rampage ended up joining up with Angle in the Main Event Mafia. That's it. That's all they have to show for it. Now, for the people asking why TNA is putting money behind Ortiz when they just released a whole bunch of wrestlers, I agree the timing is awful. They got rid of those guys and then they bring in this washed-up non-wrestler. I get that. But I don't believe for a second that TNA is paying Tito Ortiz one red cent. First of all, they probably can't afford him. That's number one. Number two, this is all coming from Spike TV. It has to be. They're the ones pulling the strings. They've got this synergy between Bellator and TNA. They love the cross-promotion. They feel it strengthens both brands. We haven't seen any evidence of this yet, but that's obviously what they're thinking by bringing all of these guys in. Dixie Carter and TNA know that without Spike TV, there is no TNA. TNA dies. TNA ceases to exist. If Spike TV is out of the picture, if they pull the plug one day, they're done. They had barely 1,500 people in that building on Thursday night, according to one person who was there. 1,500 people in a building that seats 7,500. Most of the sections were tarped off. People sitting fourth row ringside for $20. That's how bad things are for them right now. And that's with TV. Imagine if they didn't have TV. So they're at the mercy of Spike. Their hands are tied, but I'm sure they love this because it gets them publicity. Tito Ortiz is one of the most famous MMA stars of all time, and he's had some pay-per-views that have done, I mean, if not a million, I know he's had some that have done close to a million buys. So at one time, yes, Tito Ortiz was a draw. He's not a draw anymore. He's 38 years old, and 38 in fighter years is a lot older than 38 would be for you or me. His injuries, I mean, Christ, I didn't even realize that the guy had not one but two back fusions. I had read that he did one. I didn't know that he had two. Two back fusions. Spinal fusion surgery. He's had his ACL replaced. The guy is messed up. So the idea that he's now going to start training all of a sudden to be a pro wrestler is completely preposterous. That's not why he's here. He's there to help promote a fight. That fight just so happens to be against Rampage Jackson. November 2nd, it will be Bellator's first ever pay-per-view show. Ortiz has not fought in over a year. After he lost that fight, he announced his retirement. So I guess if there's one thing pro wrestling and MMA do have in common, if nothing else, it's the fact that no one ever really retires. They just kind of go away until it's convenient for them to come back. This is actually not the first time that Ortiz has popped up in TNA. He first appeared for them back in 2005 as a special referee at the Hard Justice pay-per-view. There was an NWA title match between Jeff Jarrett and AJ Styles. For some reason, I thought it was Jeff Jarrett and Kevin Nash, but I looked it up. It was actually Jarrett and Styles. He was the ref. And here on this show, he comes out. He stands on the ramp with his arms folded. Everyone else just stands around with these looks on their faces like they just shit themselves and they don't know what to do. Mr. Anderson had a stupid look on his face, but it's hard to tell if it had anything to do with Tito Ortiz because Anderson always has a stupid look on his face. I think he was born with one. Joe is holding back Rampage, who looked more lost and confused than angry. And around we went with the different camera angles showing everybody's expression and Ortiz just standing there before they just went off the air. And the really striking thing about this, to me, was how dead the crowd was for the whole thing. They either didn't know who this guy was, or they just didn't give a shit. I don't think they had a clue. Just some bald dude who walked out on the ramp. Now, compare his reaction here to the reaction that Rampage got when he first made his TNA appearance. It's like night and day. So you can't say, oh, well, you know, the fans don't care about these MMA guys. That's not true. When Rampage first came out, the people went nuts. They went crazy when he made his first appearance. I argued at the time that, you know, the Rampage thing could be a good thing for TNA because he's a charismatic guy who, if built up properly, could draw money on pay-per-view for them. The stare down with him and Angle, that was great stuff. Now, with Tito, yeah, he's a charismatic guy. I've seen him do promos in UFC before. But he's more beat up, he's more washed up, and at what point do you just say enough is enough with these MMA guys? I mean, this was one of the lamest debuts I've ever seen. This is sort of a spoiler for next week's show, so if you don't want to hear this next little chunk, just skip ahead 30 seconds. But Ortiz appears on next week's show. Again, both shows were taped the same night, so he pops up on Impact next week in a segment that sounds just like a complete waste of time. Kurt Angle comes out to tell him, I respect you. And so I'm guessing Tito probably says, well, I respect you too. Whether they have a circle jerk in the middle of the ring, I didn't read that. Thankfully, I don't think that happened. Bully Ray comes out apparently to say that he doesn't respect either one of them. I didn't hear that any sort of role was established for Tito going forward, but to go back to this Main Event Mafia Aces and Eights, or Aces and Sevens match I mentioned earlier with the loser leaving TNA forever, here's my theory on this. I figure either Ortiz is appointed the special referee for the match, just like he was back in 2005, and he ends up screwing the Mafia over by fast-counting Rampage, thus meaning that Rampage must leave TNA. I could see them doing something like that. It adds heat to the fight between Rampage and Tito, and it gets Jackson off TV, since he's going to have to start training for the fight anyway. I don't see how he's going to be able to be on Impact every week, and he sure as hell ain't going to wrestle, at least until, oh, I guess in 2 weeks maybe, but after that, he ain't going to wrestle, at least until November. So why even bother having him on TV? He's the one that, logically, it would make the most sense to get him out of there. When the day comes that he's ready, they can bring him back, because stipulations mean nothing in wrestling. Nobody's going to bat an eyelash. Nobody, believe me, nobody buys into this retirement stipulation. So, yeah, would that be a lame cop-out finish? You bet. But that's precisely why I can see them doing it. And Tito doesn't even have to be the referee. He could be at ringside doing commentary. He could just interfere. But that's my theory. And you know what? The quicker they get these guys off Impact, the better. Because it does nothing to help TNA. It's not going to make a lick of difference for them at all. Even for Bellator. How much is being on Impact really going to help with their ratings or this first pay-per-view that they're doing? If anything, it may hurt the show because you don't want to see these guys fake fighting on TV as a way to build up a real fight that people are supposed to pay money to see. So I say let Tito cost Rampage the match, then let Mr. Anderson bash Tito over the head with a ball peen hammer, and let Anderson slip on his shoelace and knock himself silly, and that way we get rid of all three of them at once. There was one really good match between Chris Sabin and Manic. And one excellent match between Austin Aries and AJ Styles in the Bound for Glory series that you really should check out if you didn't see it. You could not watch anything else from this show, and you would not have missed much. I noticed that Aries appears to be back to being a babyface now, that he and Rude are basically done as a tag team. He came out, he cut a babyface promo, hyping up the match with Styles, hyped it up as a dream match. that the fans voted to see. And Bobby Roode came out. He said that he's had a nightmare year ever since he lost the title to Aries. And that ends tonight. He beat Hernandez in a Bound for Glory series match during 7 points after smashing a beer bottle over his head. Glass just shattered everywhere. Referee Brian Hebner, whose back had been turned, played dumb. Counted three. Brian Hebner has got to be the worst referee in all of wrestling. When I saw him at the TNA show in Brooklyn last month, me and my friend, we both made comments about how he's booked to miss absolutely everything. He's booked to be the dumbest man on the face of the earth. No matter what you do in a match, if it's illegal, if it's against the rules, even if it's within his line of vision, he will somehow not see it and will count the fall anyway, and that's what he did here. Joseph Park, who had minus 10 points going into this match, pinned Jay Bradley with a Samoan drop, which moves him all the way up to minus 3 points in the Bound for Glory series. Eric Young was in Park's corner for the match. He made him wear headgear for the match to protect him from being busted open and morphing back into Abyss. I'm pretty sure that Joe Park has had his lip busted open in the past, and that's also set him off. So what the hell headgear is going to do to protect you from a punch to the mouth, I have no idea. Chris Sabin defended his TNA World Heavyweight title against X Division champion Manic midway through the show. No better way to bury your champion than by booking him in the second most important match on the card, especially one champion who needs all the help he can get. Case in point, Sabin came out to absolutely no reaction. Now, I understand there were only 1,500 people in the building, but still, that's not good. So they had a really hot sequence of moves, counters at the beginning of the match that I thought was great. They cut to commercial right after that, which was not so great. Competitive match, Manic, you know, is the X Division champion, and he's never been booked on a main event level, but he hung in there. He hung in there with Sabin all the way to the end. Sabin finished him off with the Hail Sabin. After the match, Bully Ray jumped Sabin from behind, threatened to hit him with a chain. Sabin fought back, laid out Bully Ray with an enziguri. So they will meet at Hardcore Justice inside a steel cage for the TNA World Heavyweight title in 2 weeks. ODB and Gail Kim fought to a double countout. Not really much to it. The knockouts were largely just an afterthought this week. So that was kind of disappointing. Backstage, Brooke Hogan confronted Bully Ray, her husband. Told him that she had some news about his contract signing next week with Sabin that she couldn't share with him right now, but she looked almost giddy when she was talking about this. She was teasing maybe that he wouldn't be getting his rematch unless he gives her a divorce, perhaps. She didn't say that, but I assume that must be where they're going with this. At least I hope they are. The quicker they end this and get her off TV, the better. Again, ever since she came out publicly and announced that she's engaged in real life to some, I think, football player or something like that, there's literally no point to having Brooke Hogan on television anymore. You may as well just wrap up this storyline and just get rid of her. Austin Aries and AJ Styles had a match. Austin Aries pinned AJ Styles to earn 7 points in the Bound for Glory series. This was an awesome match. I complained last week that TNA has done nothing of late with Aries or Bobby Roode. Meanwhile, all the nonsense with the Hogans continues. This week, Hulk Hogan was nowhere to be found, and Austin Aries was found in the main event. He had a 20-minute main event with AJ Styles. I would love to sit here and give TNA credit, but by their own admission on this show, the fans were the ones who voted for this match, so I'll just say, thank you, fans. They're the ones who deserve all the credit. Looked like there may have been a botch early on in the match. Aries went for a leapfrog. They both collided. Aries left the ring just to regain his composure, and it was pretty much smooth sailing after that. Styles locked on the calf killer. Aries got out of it. Aries nailed him with the brain buster. Styles kicked out of that. Tit for tat. These guys went back and forth. There was a scary spot on the ramp to the ring where AJ Styles got backdropped all the way down to the floor, which looked like it sucked. He made a thud when he hit the ground. That looked brutal. Aries then went into the ring, and he went to deliver a tope out to the floor, but Styles sidestepped him, and Aries collided with the ring steps. So back in the ring, they're trading some blows, a lot of stiff shots back and forth. Aries with a forearm. Styles landed a Pele kick. They both end up knocked out on the ground beside one another. And it looked like they were about to do the old double pin finish. But at the last second, Aries kind of, sort of got his shoulder up. And the finish, unfortunately, I don't want to say the finish ruined the match because it didn't. The match kicked ass. It's just a shame that you had such a great match with such a shitty finish. The people seemed confused. They didn't know who won until they started playing Austin Aries' music. It was really the only black spot on an otherwise really great match. It's just a shame it turned out that way. But otherwise, I thought this was just kick-ass, nonstop action. Big-time thumbs up. Then we ended with the main event Mafia, Aces and Seven stuff, which I talked about already, the big Tito Ortiz reveal. One last TNA note here, in yet another sign that the TNA-OVW relationship may not be as solid as they would have us believe, Danny Davis is no longer expected to be a judge for gut check, so he will not be on TV anymore. This comes after Bruce Pritchard left the company, which means Al Snow would be the only original gut check judge left. And considering how much of a failure that concept has been, that may spell the end for gut check, and if it doesn't, it should. Because when you end up cutting half the winners, well, you may as well just give up. Let's move on to the mailbag here. If you have questions, you can always email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. And remember, I want to hear your audio questions as well. We've been getting some pretty good ones lately. MP3 format only. And if you can keep them to around 30 seconds or so, that would be appreciated. And you can record your question in audio form, email it to me, and just be sure to put your question in written form as well in the body of your email. And with that, let's go to this week's audio question.
Hello, Solomonster. It's me, Patrick W. Phillips, your resident Harvard alumnus that's only slightly less annoying than David Otunga. My question is this. Someone brought up the idea of cashing in the Money in the Bank briefcase at a house show. When I thought about it, I can only remember one instance of a championship switching hands at a house show, that being Nunzio winning the Cruiserweight Championship at a house show a few years ago in Italy. What are some of the other instances where a championship switched hands at a house show?
Title changes at house shows. Titles have changed hands at house shows a whole bunch of times. Maybe the most famous would be Diesel pinning Bob Backlund in 8 seconds in Madison Square Garden to win the WWF title. That was back in 1994, only a few days after Survivor Series. Bret Hart, the Hitman, won his first WWF title at a house show up in Canada. He beat Ric Flair. Match never aired on TV, although they did include it on a Coliseum video release called Smack'em Whack'em, which I still remember because I actually proudly own that VHS somewhere. Edge won his first Intercontinental title at a house show against Jeff Jarrett. I think he lost it the next day. He lost it pretty quickly after. That was also in Canada, actually. I think it was in Toronto. Tag team titles have changed hands a whole bunch of times at house shows. Money Inc. and the Steiner Brothers traded the belts back and forth plenty of times back around 1993. I remember reading about all those title changes in the magazine back then. The Godwins beat the Body Donnas at Madison Square Garden. I believe that might have been the same night as the curtain call incident back in 96. And just last year, Primo and Epico beat Kofi Kingston and Evan Bourne to win the tag team titles at a house show. And that's just a few. I know there's been a whole bunch more. It doesn't happen very often, but you know, a well-placed title change at a house show, I think, can help sell some tickets, and it adds to that feeling that anything can happen. Justin Campbell writes in, I just started listening to the show about a month ago, and I've really been enjoying it. You keep talking about how the titles in WWE seem meaningless nowadays. I think it stems from the fact that when they recombined the shows, they didn't restructure the title system. What I would do is combine the WWE title with the World Heavyweight title and have that be the main prize in the company. I would take the U.S. and Intercontinental belts, combine them as well. Of course, you need to keep the tag team titles and the Divas title. The last change I would make would be to bring back the light heavyweight slash cruiserweight title like you talked about last week so that there is a belt for the high flyers. Do you think any of this is a good idea, and do you think there needs to be fewer titles? I have advocated this for some time now. Unify the two world titles into one singular WWE championship, and then do the same thing with the Intercontinental in the U.S. And you retain the Intercontinental name. So you have one WWE title, you have one Intercontinental title. I would not be opposed to a cruiserweight belt, but only if they're serious about reviving that division, and let's be honest, WWE has never shown any serious interest in those guys, even when they had their own light heavyweight division. That didn't last very long. Aside from that, I think less is more is a good slogan to go by when it comes to titles. And as far as making them more important, I don't advocate beating your champions in non-title matches all the time, which they constantly do to the point of absurdity. That's something I would not do. Look no further than Alberto Del Rio of late. Wade Barrett, when he was the Intercontinental Champion, he lost all the time. Antonio Cesaro, who started very strong as the U.S. Champion. He barely lost a match. He was pretty hot for a while. And then the bottom just dropped out for whatever reason. He pissed somebody off, somebody got bored, and he just started losing matches left and right, even while he was still the U.S. champion. Well, what does that do to the way people perceive that U.S. title when the champion just loses all the time? You got to protect your champions. That's what makes them champs and not chumps. I'll tell you what I would do. I would impose a power ranking system with a list of the top 10 contenders for the WWE title and do top 5 rankings for all the other titles. I first proposed this on Sound Off 127. If WWE wants to play around with the rankings, that's fine. So, for example, if let's say Daniel Bryan was the number 3 contender for the title and Randy Orton was number 6, and say Orton challenged him 1 week for his spot, you could do a match where Orton, should he win, would leapfrog into Daniel Bryan's position in the rankings. I'm cool with that. You know, that's fine. But I think people like numbers. I think it's one of the reasons that baseball is such a revered sport. People like numbers. They like statistics. They like to be able to play along and track all that sort of stuff. Keep the rankings current on WWE.com and yes, even in the WWE app, if you want, so that people can check back whenever they want. But this idea that any random week, anybody can just walk out and demand a title shot, I've never been a big fan of that. I think it marginalizes your titles. So we all know it's fake, but the idea is to make money off these matches. The way you do that is by giving people a reason to think that these belts actually mean something, and then when they're being defended, it's kind of a big deal. Nick in Houston, I've heard you mention how you like the tag team Demolition before, as do I. Demolition and the Hart Foundation were my favorite growing up. I've always wondered why they are not in the Hall of Fame, seeing as how they are the longest reigning tag team champions in WWE history. You said something before that if Axe and Vince McMahon could put aside their differences, then maybe they could go in. Could you elaborate on that? I never knew there was heat between the two of them. When Demolition left WWF, Axe started using the gimmick on independent shows, and he ended up getting a cease and desist letter from WWE lawyers. So what happened is he filed a law. I'm not sure how long after that it was. I've heard mid-90s. I've heard maybe a little earlier than that. But he filed a lawsuit against WWE, which I believe he lost. There has been some debate about that. Axe has done shoot interviews in recent years and made it clear that he now owns the rights to the name. So I'm not sure if he filed another lawsuit after he lost, or maybe if that original suit simply dragged on for years and years and just wasn't settled until maybe 5 or 6 years ago. That's the story I always heard. It was fairly recently that things got settled. Axe and Smash, Barry Darso, they've wrestled as Demolition together since then. They've actually wrestled for Chikara a couple of times, which will be back, by the way. I know I did a segment on Chikara a while back and the whole thing with them basically shutting down. I know most people figure it's just an angle, and if you do, you would be right. I spoke with somebody connected to them, and they will be back soon, so I just wanted to throw that in there. Derek writes in, last question, is it safe to say that AJ Styles is to TNA what Sting was to WCW? Not just in terms of his new loner character being similar to the Crow character, but in the way that he's been loyal and faithful to TNA since the beginning of his career and hasn't left, the same way Sting was in WCW. Yeah, I think he would be. I think that's a great comparison. And like Sting, whose company went out of business and got bought up by Vince McMahon, we may be able to say the same thing for AJ Styles if his company continues on the path they're on right now. History has been made here! This week in wrestling history, it was 28 years ago this week, on July 30th, 1985, at a television taping in Poughkeepsie, New York, Miss Elizabeth made her WWF debut as the new manager for the Macho Man Randy Savage. For weeks, Savage had been courted by pretty much every major wrestling manager at that time, from Classy Freddie Blassie to Jimmy Hart, Mr. Fuji, and the greatest manager that ever lived, Bobby the Brain Heenan. In the end, he chose Elizabeth, who became the First Lady of Wrestling. In reality, the two of them were already married. She had worked in the Poffo family's ICW promotion as an announcer before heading up north with her husband. Elizabeth was my first wrestling crush, as I'm sure she was for many male fans who grew up during that era. And it's a damn shame that her life ended the way it did, because I look back on Elizabeth as very different than what you would expect, especially these days, out of a diva, let's say, or a female valet. She was very quiet. Very rarely did you hear her speak. She was in Macho Man's corner, always looking, you know, very emotional and very like a deer caught in headlights sometimes. And Savage would be getting beaten up and she'd be crying in his corner. She didn't really know what to do. She, you know, cared about her man, all that stuff. WrestleMania 7, for my money, the whole thing where Savage lost to the Warrior. His career was over. Sensational Sherry, who had been managing him for some time, kicking the hell out of him. Elizabeth comes out of the crowd. And mind you, this is years after they had broken up on TV. She comes to his rescue. They embrace in the middle of the ring. There's people in the audience crying. Of course, you got Bobby Heenan on commentary making fun of those women, saying maybe their shoes are too tight. Maybe she shouldn't have had the chili dog with onions. So a little bit of levity there. But still, you know, as far as a male soap opera is concerned, in my opinion, it doesn't get any better than that. And to me, that's one of the all-time great moments and angles in WrestleMania history. Can't say that I'm as fond as of her run in WCW. Didn't really see as much of her there. I was watching more WWF than I was WCW at that time. And it just wasn't the same. The times have changed. She was older. She went back and forth, I think, heel, babyface, just like every other person on the roster. There was nothing special about it anymore. But I think even at the end, she was always a very attractive woman. She, you know, ended up with Lex Luger. We all know what happened there. And a damn shame that things ended up the way they did. 21 years ago this week, on August 2nd, 1992, Ron Simmons pinned Big Van Vader in a match in Baltimore, Maryland to win the WCW Heavyweight Championship, becoming the first African-American to hold a world championship. He was a replacement for Sting, who was injured in storyline, and it was portrayed as a big deal at that time. You would think that there's a lot they could have done to market Simmons as something of a pioneer, being the first black champion, but instead he had what I can only describe as the Chris Jericho reign as champion. Or maybe it's Chris Jericho who actually had the Ron Simmons reign as champion. Maybe that would be a more appropriate way to put it. You could even compare it to the first part of CM Punk's reign last year as WWE champion. And what I mean by that is he was never booked like a true world champion. He only had the title for a few months, and in that time he never once, not one time, did he headline a WCW pay-per-view. Now back then you didn't have pay-per-views every month like you do now, but still. I think he had the title for at least two, maybe three pay-per-view shows. Didn't headline one of them. Halloween Havoc, he defended the title against The Barbarian in the second-to-last match on the show. I'm pretty sure it was Sting and Jake the Snake Roberts in that Coal Miner's Glove match that got top billing. I mean, it's possible maybe Simmons' match went on last. I don't think they did, though. But Sting and Roberts was the true main event on that show. And then 2 months later at Starrcade, he defended the title in the third match from the top. He wrestled Dr. Death Steve Williams. First, it was a double countout, which was then changed to a disqualification win for Simmons when Steve Williams attacked him after the match. Now, keep in mind, none of these men were main event players in WCW. Barbarian was never a main eventer. I don't believe Dr. Death. He was big in Japan, but he was never a main eventer in WCW. And 2 days after Starrcade, Simmons dropped the belt right back to Vader and went right back down to the mid-card. But you could make the argument that he never really left the mid-card in the first place. A lot of people feel the only reason that Simmons even got the title in the first place was because Bill Watts, who was the promoter at the time, Jim Ross's mentor, JR worked under him early in his career down in Mid-South Wrestling. Watts made a comment in an interview in the PW Torch newsletter that was less than flattering towards gays and African Americans. You could say it was flat-out racist. Others who knew Bill Watts and worked with him and saw all the black stars that he promoted in Mid-South, like Ernie Ladd and Junkyard Dog, they would say that he wasn't a racist, but maybe just ignorant to the use of certain words. Who knows? The comment that got Watts in hot water, by the way, was, and this is a quote, he was answering a question from Wade Keller, and he said, "Why should I have to hire an effing," and then he uses the F word for homosexuals, "why should I have to hire them if I don't like them? If I don't want to sell fried chicken to blacks, I shouldn't have to. It's my restaurant." So he actually did that interview before WCW hired him as the booker, but it got published later on. And when it was, I think it was Mark Madden, if I remember correctly, who snitched him out and sent the quote to Turner Sports. And Hank Aaron, big baseball legend, got real upset about it, and Bill Watts ended up getting fired. Anyway, the point of all this is that some would say the only reason that Ron Simmons got the title was as a way for Watts to kind of say, hey, see, I'm not a racist. But then you see the way that Simmons was booked, and he certainly didn't do himself any favors, did Bill Watts, with the way he booked Ron Simmons. And lastly here, 16 years ago this week, on August 3rd, 1997, today, WWE held its 10th annual SummerSlam pay-per-view from what is now the Izod Center in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Bret the Hitman Hart defeated The Undertaker to capture his fifth WWE championship after guest referee Shawn Michaels inadvertently struck Undertaker in the head with a steel chair that was intended for Hart. This would kick off Bret's final reign as champion that would come to an end in someplace called Montreal 3 months later. But what this event is most remembered for is what happened in the Intercontinental title match between Owen Hart and Stone Cold Steve Austin. I'm sure you all know the story. Having a great match. Match went like 15 minutes, something like that. They had a few more minutes left to go. Owen whips, or actually, I'm sorry, maybe it was Austin whipping Owen into the ropes. Owen did a little flip. He ended up picking up Steve Austin for a tombstone piledriver. And instead of dropping down on his knees, kind of the way The Undertaker or Kane would do the tombstone, Owen sat down. And in doing so, Austin's head was underneath his backside. So when Owen's ass hit the ground, Austin's neck was compressed. He got spiked into the mat. And he was paralyzed. He could not feel anything, at least from the neck down, for a good 45 seconds. A very scary situation. It was obvious that he was in some distress. Vince McMahon on commentary sounded very concerned. Obviously, he sees his top draw, the future of his company, laying motionless in the middle of the ring. Austin, somehow, he got feeling back in his limbs. He was able to, they improvised the finish where he was able to roll up Owen Hart from behind. And even then, Owen Hart, you know, he tried to make it look as presentable as possible. It was a very weak-looking finish. It was obvious something was wrong. Owen still kind of kicked out at the last minute. I don't know how smart that was. He kind of kicked Austin's head a little bit. But Austin won the Intercontinental Championship and had to be helped from the ring by referees. And, you know, in the end, things worked out. Stone Cold was able to come back. He went on one of the biggest runs anybody has ever had, anywhere, ever, in any company. He was the star of the Attitude Era. He helped make that company millions upon millions of dollars and went on to become a huge star. But Austin himself has said in interviews, including one recently that I read, somebody asked him, you know, if you hadn't gotten hurt, if your neck wasn't injured, if you didn't have the spinal fusion as a result, would you still be wrestling? Or how many more years do you think you could have gotten? I don't think Austin would still be wrestling full time, but I think he said something to the effect of, I could go another 5 years if I don't get hurt. He certainly doesn't retire in 2003. So who knows? Who knows how things might have been different if Stone Cold was still around wrestling pretty much full time in 2006, 2007, 2008? How different things might have looked? How many more matches we could have seen with Stone Cold against maybe a John Cena, a Randy Orton, some of the stars that came along a little bit later on, Batista perhaps? But we were cheated out of that. You know, injuries happen. It's just a fact of life, and it's a very eerie thing. People have pointed out the fact that Steve Austin dropped Masahiro Chono on his neck in the exact same way. It was in a match in Japan in the early 90s. There's footage of it on YouTube. They're doing their thing. Austin picks him up for a pile driver and very slowly just kind of falls on his ass. Wasn't supposed to do that, but he fell on his ass, spiked Chono into... I mean, it looked bad. Spiked Chono into the mat. And supposedly, Chono himself was never the same after that. He had to adjust his style. He wasn't quite as good as he used to be. I don't know if he ever... I think he may have had surgery on his neck. I don't know if he ever did or not. But then all those years later, 5, 6, 7 years later, here's Steve Austin, and the same exact thing happens to him in that match with Owen Hart. And Austin, before the injury, was also a different wrestler than he was later on. Later on, he had to adapt his style. He became more of a brawler. He wasn't quite as flashy as he used to be. He used to be a big bumper. He didn't really take that many flashy bumps anymore. He had to adjust his style. He wasn't as much of a technical wrestler. And again, the neck issues forced him out. He missed almost an entire year. You know, the year 2000, that was all Rock and Triple H. can't really sit here and say what if, because things did kind of work out. Austin became a big star, but yeah, if he hadn't gotten hurt, we probably would have gotten more of Stone Cold. And as far as the animosity with him and Owen Hart, I've heard Austin talk about this before. I don't know that Owen ever apologized to him, and I think that was one big bone of contention with him and Austin. Why he didn't apologize, who knows? You know, I've heard a similar thing. Jesse Sorensen and Zema Ion in TNA, where, you know, Zema Ion apparently didn't apologize to Jesse until much later on. They kind of aired out their differences. But it wasn't because Zema Ion is, you know, held contempt in his heart for Jesse Sorensen. It was just the two of them had been friends. He hurt this guy. He felt really bad about it. Didn't know if Jesse kind of held him responsible for it. Didn't know what, you know, how Jesse felt about the whole thing, and just never said anything. Maybe it was a similar thing with Owen Hart. I mean, we'll never know. Unfortunately, Owen's not around. We can't ask him. But that happened 16 years ago this week at SummerSlam back in 1997. If you have emails to send me, please send them to thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solomonster. And please don't forget, you can stream the show each and every week for free in the Stitcher radio app for your mobile device, your tablet. You can type in Solomonster Sounds Off. Show should come right up. Every time you listen to the show, it helps our ranking in the sports category, so I appreciate that. And you can get every single show that we have in our archives. It is on thesolomonster.com. From this show that you're listening to now, going back many, many years, you can search the archives. You can make a PayPal donation. There's a little box on the right-hand side. You can donate however much or however little you want to, whatever you can. Every little bit helps, so I appreciate that. Episode 287 on tap for next week. Until then, be well, stay safe. Thank you for your support, and we'll see you right back here next week.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good. The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello. Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? The fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolomonster.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, The Solomonster Sounds Off.